Progressions Program. I'm Katrina So, your host for tonight. I'm so excited to be with you and answer some questions that you guys have sent in and take any live calls that anyone wants to send my way. So tonight, the phone number is always the same, but you can write it down, put on your speed dial. The number is 347-838-9945. And I'd love to talk with you live. A lot of times it's easier to dialogue and ask questions back and forth if you are live, or if you just want to call and say hi, tell me what you think about the P3 program, etc. It's always a fun thing. So again, 347-838-9945. And I've got two really great emails tonight that I want to get to. One is on dislocated shoulders and how to work with them, and the other is on clients that have lupus. So we're going to talk about those in great detail tonight, and I'm going to go ahead and start with some announcements. Just a reminder that we do have a Mat 1 and Movement Principles this weekend at Personalized Pilates. So if you're interested or you want to audit or anything, give the studio a ring, sign up with Balanced Body, all that good stuff. That's always a really great basic one to go back to because, you know, as you go along becoming an instructor, you know, you take the basics, and sometimes you don't really appreciate the detail and the nuances as you first experience them. I know I certainly didn't. But as you go through and you learn more, you kind of strip away this layer of, okay, I'm getting more and more and more advanced, and I got to start back at the beginning. Give me the fundamentals over, which is why part of the P3 program, we go back over them. And I go back over them in a different way. But again, as many ways as you can get your hands on the fundamentals, you know, experiencing them, hearing them, seeing them, having different clients work through them, it can be really, really helpful. So again, don't forget those basics and go back to them as often as you can, because you will get those clients that's all they can do. And on that note, we'll actually be talking about some of that stuff tonight. So I'm going to jump right in, and we're going to talk about, let's do the lupus one first. Okay, so I'm going to read the question, and then I want to talk about lupus in general, and then we'll go through specific to this question. All right, sure. Hi, Katrina. I hope you and your family are doing great. I have a good friend who has been diagnosed with lupus. She suffers from headaches, joint pain, and fatigue. She does not exercise regularly, but would like to possibly begin to do Pilates with me, as she has heard many wonderful things about it. Can you share with me any knowledge you have about lupus and the benefits of Pilates? There's not much information about it online, but I do know that a release of endorphins can help improve mood and reduce pain. Focusing on the core and keeping the body balanced and alignment is obviously a huge benefit to everyone. However, I wonder if some of the exercises would be a bit too hard on her joint pain. I suppose the reformer and Cadillac would be the equipment of choice for her, being that I can really personalize the spring tension. It would help enable her to get more mobility in her joints while not exhausting her more than she already is. I guess similar to the way Pilates is awesome for osteo by building bone and having tension on the joints be the least amount possible. Would this be the same benefit for my friend? I would like to be able to give her specific examples of how Pilates could help her and see if I could motivate her to get started. Any advice or knowledge you could offer would be very helpful. Well, I would love to give you some information on this. First off, I want to go through, for anybody that doesn't know, just a little bit about what lupus is, because it's kind of an odd disease. Unfortunately, it's getting more attention because more people are getting it, which is not necessarily a good thing. But again, it's kind of one of those vague ones that nobody really knows what it really is and stuff, so I want to go through what it is, and then I'll get into the exercise stuff. So first off, lupus is actually an autoimmune disease, and that just means our immune system normally fights off dangerous infections and bacteria, you know, in order to keep us healthy. But you get autoimmune disease when the immune system actually turns and attacks its own body because it gets confused that there's something foreign in there. And how exactly it does that, there's different theories and such. And there's lots of different ways this manifests itself, different types of autoimmune diseases, including systemic lupus erythematosus, which is called lupus for short, SLE. There's some different types of lupus, but this is the most common one. The exact cause of lupus is not known, but several factors have been associated, including genetics. It's not necessarily a genetic disease, but there's a lot of people in the same family that tend to have it. Now, if that's a, really a gene thing or it's just a lifestyle thing, you know, that's yet to be determined. There's several environmental triggers that have been linked to it, like ultraviolet rays, certain medications, viruses, physical, emotional stress, and trauma. So those could play a part. And then hormones. There's more lupus patients that are women than men. And so sometimes there's worsening of symptoms during pregnancy and during that time of the month and things like that. So some of these have led people to have the theories that different female hormones may play a role in lupus, but that's not something proven or anything. So I just want to throw that out there. There's different symptoms. Here are some of the most common ones. Things such as severe fatigue. And we're not just talking about like, oh, I'm kind of tired. We're talking about like debilitating fatigue. Painful or swollen joints, or painful and swollen joints. headaches. Rashes on the cheeks and nose that they call butterfly rashes. Hair loss, anemia, blood clotting problems, Raynaud's syndrome, which is where the fingers turn white and blue and tingle when they're cold. Pain in chest on deep breathing, it's called pleurisy. There's swelling and edema in the feet, legs, hands, and or around eyes. Sometimes fevers, sun and light sensitivity, abnormal blood clotting, mouth or nose ulcers. There's lots of different things. But also, the lupus is called the great imitator because its symptoms are often like symptoms of other things like rheumatoid arthritis, blood disorders, fibromyalgia, diabetes, thyroid problems, Lyme's disease, and heart, lung, muscle, bone diseases. There's tons of them that it kind of imitates. And so a lot of times it's very tricky to diagnose it. Oftentimes people will get diagnosed with some of these other things I just mentioned and then later find out, oh, no, it's really lupus. So it's very confusing. And if you're trying to figure out what you have on your own, a lot of times it can be very, very confusing because you've got all this other stuff going on. Oh, I think I have, you know, Lyme's disease. Oh, no, I have this. And it's very confusing. So if somebody does have a diagnosis for lupus, you can assume some of those symptoms, and then they'll probably tell you this particular person we're talking about has the fatigue and the painful joints and headaches and all that kind of stuff, which are, again, are very, very common and widespread. Okay, so in terms of treating lupus, the treatments that they talk about are not curative. The goal is more to ease the symptoms and, you know, help really promote quality of life. Okay, so making sure they don't go downhill in some areas is more of a preventative for compounding factors. And we'll talk about that when we get into the specific exercise treatments. So a lot of times they'll want to give you anti-inflammatory medications for the joint pain and stiffness, steroid creams for the rashes, corticosteroids for the immune response, anti-malarial drugs for skin and joint problems, et cetera, et cetera. As you all know, I am not a big fan of the drugs, and I don't think they're really doing a whole lot, except for just plain pain, you know. So you want to get to the underlying, like, what is going on here, which is hard because they don't know what's going on with lupus. I think that there's always a good amount of ideas to be looking at recommended eatings and certain foods to avoid and making sure that you're not having any flare-ups due to foods and allergies and intolerances. I think that's a huge one. Looking at different products you use, like over-the-counter, like what cleaners you use, what toiletries you use, because there are so many toxic chemicals in our lives that I think, again, it's a good idea, especially to make sure that there's nothing else compounding your problems. If not to get rid of it, at least to not exacerbate the symptoms and such. Okay, so exercise can help lupus. And there's a lot of talk about lupus with arthritis, and especially rheumatoid arthritis, because rheumatoid arthritis is also autoimmune disease, and it's also got a lot of the joint pain and such. And so there's a lot of commonality when you're talking about lupus with that. So first off, for lupus, you want to avoid outdoor exercise in the sun, because that can trigger flares with the sunlight. Not usually a problem in the Pilates studio. you want to encourage your client that has lupus to listen to their body and exercise when the symptoms are minimal. Now, this can be really tricky because it's not like you can just cancel their appointments all the time when they have flare-ups and such. And so we'll talk about what to do when they do have a flare-up, because you really can't be changing your whole cancellation policy based on that. So you really want to make sure that you are clear with this person ahead of time. You know, if you think you're going to have a flare-up, 24 hours, or I will have to charge you. Okay, this is a really big thing. Be clear ahead of time. Let them know that you sympathize with them, but that you are running a business and you have to have your boundaries. If they are having a flare-up, we'll talk about what to do with them with that. Okay, when you're starting out with them, especially like in this particular case, this person doesn't exercise regularly, but even if they did, when you're doing something new, you want to start gradually and build up slowly. Okay, this is a good thing to do with anybody, but especially with lupus. If you do too much or increase too quickly, it can actually bring on their symptoms and make things worse. So you want to like up it by like 10% in terms of a gauge of how much to increase. So in terms of the duration, intensity, and everything, like 10% per week. And we'll talk about what that looks like and how to manage that with an hour to work with in a little bit. Okay, also, don't exercise if the joints feel hot, swollen, or tender. If they're hot, swollen, or tender, the exercise could and probably will make these symptoms worse. Again, you can expect some pain, but you also need to be safe. So we'll work and talk with that. Some days are better than others. Again, pay attention to the body and modify. Okay, so most of the studies that they're talking about in terms of exercise, talk about that they've shown that walking and stretching help. So getting range of motion and moving the joints in terms of stretching and getting the blood circulating and some cardiovascular movement, and not necessarily running, but just, you know, casual walking can actually help. So those two elements, and I wanted to not just say stretching and walking, but say what about it helps. You know, so the walking, it's getting the blood moving. And remember, when you get your blood pumping, again, you don't have to be doing high aerobic, huge exercise. Just walking can get your blood pumping. Not only does that help get oxygen to the joints, which is huge in terms of pain relief and such, but it gets the toxins out of the joints. So you got to remember, what does the blood do? What does the circulation do? That also is going to help with the edema that we mentioned in terms of the swelling, in terms of getting those stagnant fluids down in the body to pump back up towards the center and get them out in the excretion, so the pee. So you've got to do that. Very, very helpful for that. And again, that goes for arthritis as well. The stretching, the big thing that's going to be helpful there is that you're getting the range of motion. When people have lupus, a lot of times they tend to like to keep their joints bent. It has kind of a protective, less painful feeling to it. But over time, what happens is if you'll change the resting length of the muscle and they won't be able to possibly open all the way. And that's a huge thing. You always want to have full range of motion of your joints and full use of them. So we don't want our joints to become even more stiff and more painful by keeping them always bent. So stretching and just having them, reminding them, a daily thing to open the joints up and get the full range of motion and enjoy that. I'm not talking about, you know, getting them to do the splits and all that kind of stuff. I'm just talking about moving the body, okay? It's huge. Okay, so those two things are what we're really looking for. And then also, it's very important for lupus clients to not lose strength. So a very common problem experienced by patients that have lupus is a progressive reduction in their activity and exercise, meaning they just get less and less active because they're tired. It hurts. I mean, give them a break. It would be very, very easy to just do less and less, right? But what happens is that there's a cycle of inactivity and deconditioning that results. So you get increased symptoms and therefore further reduction in activity in order to avoid more discomfort. So the end result is a spiral downwards that results in the inability to comfortably do anything, even the most basic activities of daily life. So you want to really encourage them not to you know, become susceptible to this downward cycle of inactivity. You want to make sure they keep their muscle tone that they have. So you're not necessarily trying to make them into a bodybuilder or anything, but you want to keep that. But you don't want to hurt them or overexert them or, you know, overdo it so they get joint pain and such. So you want to proceed carefully and talk to them, etc., throughout the whole thing. It's very important to maintain strong muscles. The stronger the muscles and tissue around the joint, the better that they're going to be able to support and protect those joints, even if the joints themselves are weak and damaged. So if you don't exercise, then your muscles are going to become weaker and smaller, and your bones become more brittle and more prone to fracture and such. So this is super, super important. In exercising, the most common risk is to aggravate the lupus by working the joints or muscles too much. Okay, so that's where we go back to go slow, progress them slowly, add more slowly. Don't feel bad giving them breaks, okay? And this is where you're going to need to really talk to the client and go slow. Usually, I am the first one to say push, 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 you know, try to get them to not have breaks and stuff. This is the opposite of what you want to do with somebody with lupus, okay? We have in the past worked with clients to have them do half an hour sessions to start with and such. It's kind of a little iffy depending on the studio you're in because it can be really tricky. But even if they are doing a whole hour, that doesn't mean they need to work out the entire hour. Okay, so giving them water breaks, you know, giving them breaks and have slower transitions. You know, let them have a little time while you're talking in between. This is actually something you want to build in on purpose to help them to be able to go through the whole hour and not have too much happen. Okay, so this seems so odd for me to be saying to do these things that I usually am harping on not doing. Okay, a lot of times instructors are talking to their clients all during the session, and it's because the instructor has a personal need to talk and jabber and feel get their self-worth met by connecting personally with the person. And that's inappropriate. That's to the client's detriment. But this kind of talking and is going to be to the client's benefit because you're trying to make sure you don't give them too much so that they get hurt. Okay, so again, you always want to ask, why are you doing what you're doing? Because there's always a reason to do almost anything that you could possibly imagine. Okay, so if I seem like I'm contradicting myself normally from what I say, I am. All right, so somebody with lupus is going to benefit from a balanced exercise program with different types of exercise. So in the Pilates studio, what this means is that we want to do range of motion, strengthening, and endurance exercises. Okay, that sounds like, well, of course, that's what we always do. But you want to ease them in slowly. So what seems like endurance to you is not going to be what seems like endurance to them, especially if they've had lupus for a while and have already started to go down the road of deteriorating and losing muscle strength and all that kind of thing. We talked about why you want to do stretching and range of motion exercises. So you can do passive range of motion or active range of motion. And we've talked about this before. Passive stretching or range of motion, kind of synonymous there, what we're talking about. Those are going to involve somebody assisting them or them using their body weight to do the movement so that there's no muscle contraction. And basically they're holding something. All right, so you can passively, and with something like lupus, just passively moving their arm around in a circle, you know, can be, you know, something that you're doing. And in Pilates, we have this fabulous ability to use the springs to help us with that, so we can get things that are almost passive and really where the machines are helping without us as the practitioner having to do a lot of this. And I really want to highlight this because this is one of the ways and reasons that Joe actually started Pilates. A lot of the wounded and injured and sick people that were in the internment camp that he was in were just confined to bed rest. They didn't have a lot of the information about how to treat things or what, you know, how to diagnose things even. So they're just put on bed rest. And a lot of times, you know, yeah, you might have a broken leg, but the rest of your body works fine. You shouldn't be just confined to the bed. And so he would go around and give them these passive range of motion, passive stretching exercises where he would move their whole body. And he quickly figured out that gets very tiring and came up with ways to use the bed springs to create the first Cadillac out of the beds that were in the hospital that he was working at and helping out at. So, again, this is really part of Pilates. It doesn't show up necessarily in the regular exercises, but it really does, because that's where things like leg springs on the Cadillac and tower kind of came from. So you can use them in this kind of an application very nicely. It's going to look different than if you're using general fitness or, you know, extreme conditioning. But again, you can use the same exact exercise and just modify it, change the duration, change the tempo, change the intensity, change the choreography, and just make it simple and slow and you know, soothing instead of go, 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 and it becomes a completely different thing. Okay, so during a flare-up, this passive range of motion, passive stretching, can actually be very helpful because there's not a lot of muscle contraction, and yet the joint gets some movement. The opposite would be the active range of motion, and those are really great immediately following a flare. So the person, the client, is performing the movement without assistance, and they're getting full range of motion. So there is muscle contraction present, and this is kind of, you know, what we're using in all of our traditional Pilates exercises with that. So again, traditional Pilates is more active range of motion. You can make it more passive by using the springs in a different way, or just passively doing it for them, or just regular passive stretching, some different things. But my point is, if you use the, basically the sliding continuum you have in Pilates, you can help them to be more active by utilizing the equipment to help them less, or more, rather. And if you want it to be more passive, so like during a flare, use the equipment to help them more and assist them more. So you've got this great continuum. And again, depending on the actual exercise that you choose, you can slide that up or down, which is so fabulous, because usually in most settings, you know, you have the exercise, there it is. But in Pilates, we can adjust it and adapt it so much that can be really, really helpful, even if somebody's having a flare-up. So again, why you don't necessarily have to change your cancellation policy or something, if they are having a flare-up, you can do different things that day. Okay, so another thing that you can do, which is super helpful, is isometric exercises. So there's no joint movement at all, and the muscle length stays the same, the muscle contraction is present, but you're not going to annoy the joints at all, okay? Meaning there's not even any movement in the joint. So for example, if you're doing something with your arms, maybe, just straighten your legs straight out in front of you and isometrically hold the leg straight. Okay, so say you're sitting on the chair and you're doing the mermaid. If you straighten your legs out in front of you while you're doing it, you're getting really great quad work to straighten the legs and hold them up there, but there's no pressure and annoyance on the knees. So if the knee is a joint that usually annoys them, maybe on a day it's not super annoyed, you want to really focus on this because it's not going to annoy the joint, but you can get some good quad strength. Versus doing something like the Russian squats or something, which is like full range of motion, and they need a lot more strength to be doing it. So you can pick the exercise depending on the day, whether they're having a flare or how much strength they've progressed through and such. And this is going to be so different, because if you get somebody that's really strong and young that gets lupus, it's going to look very different than if you get somebody that's, you know, 70 years old and really weak that gets lupus in terms of how much they can do. It's not like everybody with lupus has the same level that they're at even. Okay, so the other type of exercise would be more of an aerobic exercise for cardio fitness that's going to help the lungs and everything. So you can help them work out longer without tiring as quickly, but you need to be careful that you don't overdo it with that. And again, that's not necessarily what we're focusing on in the Pilates studio, in terms of getting like the traditional cardio, like running and bicycling and such, but you will get their heart rate up, and that can really help them get more stamina. So you're getting kind of all these different things that are good for them in one place, which especially for somebody with lupus is very, very helpful, because they don't have to do three or four separate types of exercise to get the strength and the stretching and the cardio. They can get all three with one-stop shopping, which is very helpful, because, again, you've got the extreme fatigue. They can't handle a whole lot with that. So if they're having a flare, All right, so they call in. They're saying, hey, Susie Joe, I want to work out, but I'm having a flare, and I can't do it. Encourage them to come in. And on the days that maybe the joints are more painful and swollen, you know, cut back on the number of exercises you do. And then gradually add them back when the tolerance increases. So the next time, if they're not having a flare-up, then you can maybe add some back. So if there's a huge decline in the performance, you know, you might want to have them talk to their doctor. But if they're just having a bad day and things are more swollen, that doesn't mean they shouldn't come in. What you want to do is just be a little kinder to them. Maybe have a little more breaks, maybe change the springs a little bit, pick a little easier exercises, and just get their blood circulating. And it's hugely helpful. And the clients that I've worked with lupus have found it that they're glad they came at the end. You just want to make sure you don't overdo it. Don't act like they're going to break on you, but you do want to just cool it down. Talk to them, ask them, you know, if they've been coming in for a while, they usually can tell you, you know what, I can't do that today. That's going to be too much. And just let them have breaks as, you know, you want to really just be sensitive to what's going on and how much is too much and have them connect in with that. It can be very, very helpful because, like I said, with the edema, getting the circulation will help get the edema out. It'll help get the good nutrients to the joints and help with the swelling and such and really help get the healing going into the joints without putting a lot of stress. Remember, you know, in most of the literature that you're reading, whether it's online or whatever, they're going to be talking about traditional personal training, weights, and that kind of thing, which are extremely harsh on the joints. We've talked about this in terms of arthritis and other joint problems, but it's the same thing with lupus. If you have a client that has joint problems and joint pain, go back and review the lesson on the springs and settings because we talk about how the springs work. But basically, instead of it being like, okay, one spring equals 15 pounds, it doesn't work like that. Every inch or even millimeter that the spring is pulled, it changes how much tension there is on the spring. So like as you push the carriage out, you know, that's several feet that the spring gets stretched, and each millimeter is a different amount of weight. So what that means is as you press the carriage out, say you're doing footwork, you're going to have more pressure on the muscle at the end range when your legs are straight. As you come in, there's more pressure on the joints, okay, that you've got the bending pressure on the joints, the knee joint in particular we're talking about. Now, which part has more strength in the spring? Well, the out phase when your legs are straight on the footwork is going to have all where the pressure is on the muscle. That's where the spring is being pulled the longest, and so all the there's so much more tension. So it's more, quote, weight, if you will. People can't get away from that word. On the in phase, there's almost no pressure in terms of resistance and, quote, weight because the spring is at its shortest point. And so that's the point that it has the pressure on the joint. So it is very, very good and helpful for anybody with any joint problems like osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, that kind of stuff, because there's just not that pressure on the joint that people find. And I think that's why older clients especially or clients with issues like arthritis just flock to Pilates because it's so nice on the joints. And there's so many new machines that are coming out that are mimicking this. All those Kinesis machines and everything that are so ridiculously expensive are mimicking this dynamicity of the more tension where it's the muscle versus less tension when it's the weight on the joint. And that's really built into Pilates. If you're doing the classical work, it's going to just be part of it. And so that's one of the beautiful things about working with somebody with lupus. Okay, so if they're having a flare, if they're having a flare, you just need to slow it down, focus more on just getting their blood pumping and getting the general joints moving. You know, so doing things like feet and straps, leg circles. Okay, just real easy, smooth. You're not trying to do, you know, focus on all the different things to make it harder, bigger, better, faster, all that kind of stuff. And things like maybe some frogs, you know, they're doing maybe, you know, some light spring, arm circles and stuff, sitting up, things like that. Just getting some general range of motion. It doesn't have to be huge end range of motion. Just getting the joints moving. And you can tell if they're getting their blood circulating by when they're, you know, they have a little bit harder time talking to you. That was my imitation of being out of breath, which probably didn't convey over the audio, but you want to get their heart rate a little bit up, but it doesn't have to be because they're jumping up and down, which is putting excess pressure on their joints, or even walking fast. You know, walking does put quite a bit of pressure on the joints for that. One of the exercises they encourage for lupus as well as for arthritis and such is to do more cardio that would be more in the pool, so there's less weight-bearing on the joints, and that can be really great. However, I don't know. Most pools are, like, loaded with chlorine, which is very, very toxic chemical. So if there is some toxicity of things, that might not be helping. Plus, a lot of people don't have a pool or don't want to get in the pool, especially if it's winter, so there can be things with that as well. All right, so we want to really encourage them not to exercise too much. So some ways to tell if it's too much is if they have joint or muscle pain that the exercise causes that lasts for more than 2 hours after exercise. I think you and the clients probably know that, but sometimes it's, you know, safe to mention that stuff. And any time that you begin something new, you may feel that your heart beats faster, your breath is faster, muscles are tense, and you're more tired. But you should feel awake up feeling more fresh in the morning. And so that's a normal reaction to exercise. If you're feeling like just dead the next day, maybe it was too much. Okay, so you need to slow down. And that's where you want to really get a good conversation of, okay, how did that work for you last time? And then you need to remember as an instructor that this is something that changes and is very dynamic, so every day is different. So if you're charting, you know, I did this with her, she said it felt good. That doesn't necessarily mean that if you do that again, you know, 2 weeks from now, it's still going to feel good. It could be a little different. So you want to be very dynamic in your adjustments to the lesson plan that you're going to choose for her. Whether you make one or use one that's already done, you want to really go with the flow. You want to really talk to the client and address them, you know, because that's the person that's in front of you. All right, so hopefully that covered some of your questions. And in terms of specific examples of how Pilates can help, I think my biggest thing would be about the springs. The springs are very, very easy on the joints. The blood flow and everything is very, very huge, getting the cardiovascular. People don't talk about Pilates being for cardio because, you know, most people think of cardio exercises for cardio. It's just so huge nowadays. But really, Joe talked a lot about this effect in his books, but he didn't talk about cardio exercise. He talked about the breath and everything, and the breath is pumping the cardio, and it's really important to get that connection. So that is a really huge part of Pilates, is the circulation. He talks a lot about the circulation, which is, again, a different way of saying the cardio, okay, and why it's so good. Hopefully that helps. Again, if she wants to get started, I would just go real slow. I would encourage her to do whatever she needs to do for headaches, joint pain, and fatigue, but don't come in on any pain medication, okay? Have her take it afterwards if she needs to. And have her, you know, she probably knows if, you know, mornings are better for her usually or evenings. And make sure she schedules at a time when she's not at her most tired. Okay, if she comes in her most tired, it's not going to go well. And so when you're scheduling her, make sure she takes that into consideration. Sometimes people just look at their calendar and says, oh, that time works, but they're not thinking about that they're exercising at that time, and that may not be the best time. So just a little logistical thing to think about. With headaches, the bright lights might be an issue and such, so maybe she even wants to wear sunglasses in the studio, because unfortunately we have not figured out a great way to not have the light shining down on people, and sometimes, again, the UV ultraviolet lights and stuff can be a problem, and especially if they're having a migraine or headache and stuff. Okay, but since she doesn't exercise regularly, start slow, Okay, maybe even have her do some walking or something to get her exercising and her heart rate going, you know, a couple times a week before she starts her Pilates, just so she doesn't overdo it with an hour of Pilates. And just go slow with her. Do fundamentals to start with. This is a great example of what I was talking about at the beginning in terms of going over your basics. And this is a good example. You don't have to do a full repertoire of all the advanced stuff on all the equipment. A lot of the mat fundamentals are going to be so good for this type of person. And those are their exercises. That's why those were created. Eve Gentry was one of Joseph Pilates, students who he trained as a teacher, and she moved out to New Mexico because her husband, I guess he had a job or something there, and she found that the people that she started working with there, Joe had actually made her some equipment and sent it off with her, the people she had, they couldn't do the basic stuff. They couldn't do the regular Pilates. They had issues and stuff going on with their bodies that precluded them from doing it, so she broke stuff down into little pieces, and she kept breaking it down into smaller and smaller pieces until it worked. And then she could build them back up. And that's what those fundamentals are. Those have become part of the Pilates curriculum, but that's where they come from. They're from Eve Gentry. And Michelle Larson has carried them on, and there's so many of them, and it's awesome because, again, just take things apart to their barest, smallest pieces, and if people have issues, like we're talking about with lupus, start them there. Go back to the basics, and they're going to have better mechanics. They're going to get the circulation. They're going to get the nice, easy joint movement, and they don't have to be pumping and grinding like in a gym, and that's because that's not what's going to help them. She needs to remember that and find where she can enjoy movement, and that's what we're all about. Remember, that's our tagline at the end of the show every time. Remember, help your clients to enjoy movement. That's what it's all about. So hopefully that would inspire your friend with lupus, because I firmly believe that everybody deserve to enjoy movement, and that you can help her do that if you appropriately modify the things that she's got going on. So a lot of that's going to be about just talking to her, which is awesome that you're already friends because you've built that rapport, and she can really be honest with you, hopefully, and let you know what's working and what's not, and that kind of thing. Just don't let the friendship get clouded when you get to the cancellation policy and stuff. I would talk about that with her ahead of time so that she knows that you can adjust it, because a lot of people get very freaked out, like, well, I have to cancel because I can't do anything. No. We have so many different levels. I can adjust it for you, and we can just get you to feeling in a better place, okay? All right, so if you have follow-up questions or anything, let me know, and I'd be happy to talk that through with you further if you want to, like, I don't know. Anyways, if you have follow-up questions, let me know. And hopefully that was helpful to you and anyone else that has a client with lupus. Okay, here is the next question. Hi, Katrina. One of my clients has had each shoulder dislocated, one when he was 16 and the other one several years ago. He has good range of motion, but one exercise he can't do is mermaid. He can't bring the opposite arm up and overhead. If we do mermaid with the push-through bar, I just have him bring the arm in front of him shoulder height. If I wanted to do mermaid on the reformer, I'd choose Cleopatra. I know he's missing a lot of the stretch when we do mermaid with the push-through bar. Should I be doing something different on the tower that will stretch out the sides or cue mermaid differently? What am I missing when I choose Cleopatra instead of mermaid on the reformer? Does mermaid and side by a twist equal Cleopatra? Thank you for clarifying. So this is a great question, and I want to just take this opportunity to discuss shoulder dislocations, because sometimes this word is thrown around and people don't necessarily know what it means and why it happens, and then I will get into the specifics and talk about mermaid and such specifically. All right, so a dislocated shoulder, what we're talking about here is when the ball and socket, so the glenohumeral joint part of your shoulder, the ball part, the humerus, actually forcefully comes out of its normal position in that glenoid fossa. Right, so ball out of the socket. And if you've seen pictures of this, it's not pretty. You look at it and you go, ooh, that doesn't look good. usually this is associated with extreme pain and inability to move the arm until it's put back into the socket. So this is a big thing. Okay, this isn't something that just happens and you're like, I wonder if this happened. I'm not sure. Usually you know. as opposed to a shoulder subluxation. just a fun word to say, subluxation. That's where it's partially dislocated. So the shoulder, the ball part is partially out. It's not fully out before they put it back in. So what causes this? Okay, there's three main reasons that this can happen. So the first one, and probably the most common, is that there's something traumatic that happens. There's some kind of a high-speed injury where something is smashed, or like a football tackle or a fall or some kind of weird accident. My mom had one happen in some freak boating accident where she ended up hanging and dangling by an arm and it dislocated. Weird things, okay? We're talking about big things. Things that are not normal, okay? That'd be one cause. The second one would be repetitive shoulder ligament overstrain. So there's several sports such as like swimming, tennis, throwing sports, volleyball, that kind of thing, that would repeatedly have this overhead motion that can overstretch the shoulder ligaments and that whole joint capsule. And when that happens over time, it just might make it a little looser, which makes it harder for the rotator cuff muscles to maintain that shoulder stability and then possibly lend itself to a dislocated shoulder. That's not to say don't swim because you will dislocate your shoulder for sure. It's saying that you could set yourself up to do that. Now, you could really work on it. A professional level, a lot of these athletes would really make sure that they have the protective mechanism muscularly, but again, it's just setting them up with that repetitive overstretching of the shoulder joint in areas that most people wouldn't do that much tension on those ligaments to overstrain them if they weren't playing those sports. And then the third would be multidirectional instability. So this is where, you know, some people are just so lax in their ligaments genetically, like this is just how they are, that the shoulder is just very unstable in multiple directions, and it just, the shoulder kind of feels loose, and it can dislocate any direction repeatedly. And, you know, a lot of times we call these people double-jointed, hypermobile, that kind of thing, and it's just typically very common for them to be able to dislocate shoulders and stuff. And a lot of times they can just pop it back in. Creepy. You might know someone that does this. This is not a good thing. This is the dark side of hypermobility, because this kind of stuff can happen. And this type of person typically does not respond with much success to surgical stabilization. They are best managed with thorough shoulder stabilization through strengthening programs. So really, really important. The traumatic stuff, again, does really well a lot of times when you have some surgery and stuff, but a lot of times there's other issues going on that would cause the surgery because it's a crazy traumatic thing. But you want to just understand that muscularly you want to protect any of all the joints from these kinds of issues. So let's see. From here, where do I want to go? Okay, well, you want to focus on treatment. So if somebody has a dislocated shoulder, I'm saying this because hopefully it's obvious, but you have to reduce the joint. That means that you have to relocate it. You have to put that femur or that humerus back into the socket and get that glenohumeral joint stable, okay? That's the most important thing. That could be done manually. It could be done surgically, et cetera, but it needs to be done first. Then you're going to work on pain relief. So you want to minimize swelling and protect the tissue, and usually that's going to mean that you have a sling to support and immobilize your shoulder for several weeks and just let it try to heal and manage the inflammation. A lot of times people are taking medicine for this. They're in a lot of pain. There's a lot of swelling and things like that. So they use things like ice and e-stim and acupuncture and taping techniques and massage and stuff like that to try to work with it. So after that phase, you're going to want to start to maintain and restore the muscular strength and control. It's very, very important to the rotator cuff muscles to dynamically stabilize your shoulder joint. So you've got to get it stabilized in a dynamic way where it's actually very functional. And so that means a variety of movements, lots of different things. And I'll talk more about how to do that in a little bit. Then you want to progress to normal range of motion, okay, that they can regain full shoulder motion, full function. That's where you're working towards in the next phase. And then preventing it from happening again. So important. So this should be a sliding scale is my point. This shouldn't be something that is like, oh, I can never do this ever again. When you have somebody that has a shoulder dislocation, what you want to think about is usually they'll talk about I dislocated anteriorly. So that means the head of the humerus went forward, okay, out the shoulder capsule to the front. And so anything that's going to drive the head of that humerus that direction is going to risk re-dislocating it. Re-dislocate, is that a word? I don't know. It is now. Dislocating it again. Sometimes it'll go posteriorly, but usually it goes anteriorly. And again, it depends on what type of, you know, was an injury, a crazy trauma, that kind of thing, what caused it. But typically, if it's just overuse thing, it goes anteriorly. What does that mean? That means that if you're trying to avoid it happening again, first off, let's make sure we avoid the motions that would cause that to happen again. So let's talk in the Pilates studio. If you have their arms, their hands reaching behind their body, so their shoulder is in extension, then the head of that humerus is driving forward. And depending on where gravity is, where the resistance is, that could be putting too much pressure. It could be putting too much pressure if somebody is new to this motion just by that. You know, say you're doing pulling straps, that would be enough to send it out forward, especially if it's early recovery phase. But typically the most pressure you would get is if you're doing something like leg pull-up, so on the mat where you're in like an upside-down push-up, so your hands are behind you, chest to the ceiling, and your whole body weight is reaching down with gravity while the head of that arm bone is pressing up through the front of that capsule. Again, that would just like set someone up for dislocating again. So that kind of a movement where you have all that weight and pressure with their hands, your weight bearing on the hands behind them, that would probably be something I would just stay away from. So that would be because it would cause a dislocation. Now, my questions, if I had you live on the phone, would be, you said that he can't do it. My question would be, can he not do it because he just doesn't have the motion, or can he not do it because there's pain? All right, so I'm going to give you both scenarios, and you can answer the question for yourself. That way people can, if they have different client that's slightly different, that's fine. So if it's because he can't do it because he's in pain, then I would stop right before he gets to pain in that range of motion and just make sure his mechanics are really, really good. So what I mean by that is make sure, so you were talking about with the arm reaches overhead. I don't care if it's mermaid. I don't care if it's, say he's doing elephant, say he's doing short box, flat back, say he's doing leg springs with the arms overhead, and any of those things that are going to have that arm overhead. And you want to make sure that if they're doing that, they have full upward rotation of the scapula and they're really getting good mechanics. So wherever in that phase he has to stop because of pain, back off like a millimeter so he's not in pain. We don't need to practice pain. We're already quite good at it. And then make sure the mechanics are really good. So make sure that serratus is stabilized. So if he's reaching kind of up to reach overhead, and say he can only get two-thirds the way up, make sure he slides the shoulder blade down and reaches out those fingertips to widen the scapula so he's not pinching the scapula together. He's pulling them apart or pushing them apart, however you want to talk about it. And any kind of imagery of that, spreading the wings, reaching wider, that kind of thing would help get the good mechanics. That's what you want to do. Now, if it's the other option and he can't do it, quotes, I got my, you can't see my air quotes, but I'm doing it with my fingers, because he just doesn't have that range of motion, well, then this is something different. This is where I would actually encourage them to go further. That is okay if it doesn't go very far, but we want to practice it because we want to get that full range of motion. Anytime you prevent a body part from doing a movement, like would happen in the healing phase of a shoulder dislocation, meaning they're in a sling, they don't move their arm for like 6 to 8 weeks or something, or more depending on what would all happen, you're going to lose range of motion, and so you have to actively work to get it back. And if you just can't bring it up because it just doesn't go anywhere, that's where you want to retrain neuromuscularly those muscles to be able to do it. You need to stretch it out, open it up, and work for it. So sometimes a little encouragement with some tactile cues and just encouraging him to do it from the inside out, meaning he's reaching and pushing and from as far as he can go. And that's as far as he can go. That's okay, but he's working on trying to go further. So there's two things there. Is it pain? Is it just I'm not good at this? Okay, so I'm going to leave that alone. Now, on your other questions, in choosing mermaid versus Cleopatra and all that stuff, what you have done is you have taken out the angle that he can't do. And for just sake of argument, we're going to say pretend it's pain. He can't do it because it's painful to him. So if it's painful, first off, we want to avoid pain. And you'd want to examine why it's painful and can you improve his mechanics and any muscle balancing concepts to get rid of that pain. But that's a separate subject. But in the meantime, if you're doing mermaid, yes, you want to do exactly what you did in terms of choosing mermaid on the Cadillac and just having their arm in front of him. You could do it where they're on the reformer and the opposite arm doesn't reach overhead. Cross it across their chest and get it out of the way. And then they can still get the side bending and everything and the bottom arms gain the stabilization and everything. And that's fine too. So I don't think your choice was bad. It's you're adjusting to what the client can do. And again, we're assuming it's because of pain. Now, you asked, what am I missing when you choose Cleopatra instead of mermaid? And does mermaid and side body twist equal Cleopatra? So mermaid, you have side bending for the torso. As side body twist, you've got some flexion and rotation. And the rotation is really up high in the rib cage. Cleopatra, you have this side bending and rotation. So they're subtly different, but yeah, they are pretty similar. I don't know that I would say they equal each other because, quite frankly, every exercise in the Pilates studio is subtly different. Even if you're doing something like Swan, if you do Swan on the Cadillac versus, you know, even just staying on the Cadillac, roll down bar versus the push through bar, they're very different. There are different angles on the shoulders. There's different mechanics going on. You know, if you do it on the ladder barrel versus on the long box versus, you know, with your hands on the foot bar versus your feet on the foot bar, I mean, it completely changes where the closed chain is and what's going on. Some of those swans can be incredibly difficult on the shoulder, like from the floor with the chair, versus some of them are not very hard at all on the shoulder, you know, and so it's like on the seat, on the chair. So you can pick ones depending on what's going on for that person and still get the spinal movement. Same thing, and this is what you're doing for this client. Instead of having the arms up that is bothering them, you've chosen to keep the arms down, but you found another place to get the rotation. So instead of doing that mermaid side body twist, you did Cleopatra and or did Cleopatra instead of those and stuff. I think that was a great choice. Okay, I don't want to say they equal each other, but yes, you're substituting one side bending and rotation of the torso with another one, and so they're getting that movement and in a very similar fashion. And again, that's also nice because they're in a similar position depending on the flow and what you're doing with each other. So hopefully that makes sense. Personally, I think that the arm overhead movement is critical for so many daily life motions that I would just, I'm real hesitant to say just avoid it with anybody. So unless they're in pain, I would really try to work on it gradually and nicely. You don't want to rip anything or do anything bad, but I think my favorite thing to work on is elephant. Work on the mechanics for elephant because you're upside down, you have gravity working with the client to get the shoulders stable, and it doesn't bother shoulders as much. So my question would be, does elephant bother them? Because if elephant doesn't bother them, then there's something mechanical wrong that they need to work on. So put him in elephant, work on the shoulder blades going wide, have their elbows stay absolutely straight and pull the foot bar wider to get that serratus anterior working and really get the upward rotation of those scapula and really feel the head of the arm bone slide into that glenoid fossa so that there's that big hole between their ears and shoulders, that kind of a thing, and really work on the shoulder mechanics. Maybe the carriage moves. I'm famous for doing elephant and nothing moves, and they're just working so hard and their shoulders are exhausted because there's so many fabulous ways you can work on the shoulder mechanics in elephant. That's where I would go with this person to try to see, is this something that is legitimate? They physically can't do it. It causes pain. Or is this just my relationship to gravity is such that I can't do it without causing pain because I'm not strong enough and to do it against gravity? So flip them upside down, get gravity working with them, and then see if you can get the neurological connections to get the right alignment upside down where gravity is working with you, and then later flip them back upside upright. Okay, and in the meantime, you can do Cleopatra instead of mermaid. Okay, hopefully that helps. And one of the reasons I think that's so important is because there's so many muscles, your lats and everything, and your inner, I mean, there's so many different complexity to that shoulder girdle that if you just avoid everything and never work on it and don't figure out what's going on, a lot of times people go to do something and they don't think about it and they really hurt themselves even worse because you need to bring your arm over your head in daily life and they just do weird, wonky compensation patterns to avoid that. And I've seen just very bizarre things because they didn't want to get that range of motion back because they were kind of scared of it and that kind of thing. All right. So let me know if that answered your question, and hopefully that helped any of the rest of you that might have clients that have had dislocated shoulders. One thing I will say is both of these dislocated shoulders, the one when he was 16, the one that he did just several years ago, are not acute injuries. So I want to highlight that when I'm kind of encouraging this discussion and work harder and stuff. If somebody with acute injury, you want to work very, very gently, and this is not where you're going to be working. You're not going to be taking them to elephant, okay? So I just want to make sure that that disclaimer is out there and that is very obvious for people. So I hope you guys have a great night, and send me your questions, and we will get them answered and give you more information on this. I just want to encourage you to remember that everybody deserves to enjoy movement. Thanks. That's all for tonight.